Welcome to the OA Light a Candle Meeting podcast. Visit our website at www.oalaig.org, where you'll find several speaker feeds with over 400 speaker files, forms for ordering CDs for these speakers, and a place to donate to keep this special service active. I would now like to introduce our speaker for tonight, Jonathan.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Hess, a compulsive overeater, and I'm grateful to be here tonight, and happy birthday to the ladies. Thank you for your example, and thanks to the gentleman who helped out with the OA birthday party. That was quite an event last week, and I really enjoyed that cabaret. I had fought going to the OA birthday party the last 4 years. My OA sponsor tried to get me to go many different ways, and I come from a lot of AA conventions and things like that, and I hadn't been to too many conventions lately. I didn't want to go. And they tried to hook me into one commitment, and that fell through for whatever reason. And then they needed me to help them with something else, and it was great. I mean, I'm saying, God, what did I fight this thing for? It was so wonderful. And that cabaret was incredible. So, anyway, I'm grateful to be here. I want to thank Martha for asking me, and your secretary, Michelle. It's an honor and privilege to share with you and to be asked back again. It's a big honor and privilege. You know, there's a saying in the program that speaking in meetings is a win-win thing. If they don't like you, they don't ask you back, so you don't have to come back. And if they do, it's always nice to be asked back. So it's very true. I guess I'll just try to go through this rather quickly so I can get into some recovery. But I'm born. I'm all Californian, and my mother was married with my dad for about 8 years before they finally had open her fallopian tubes, and she got pregnant, and that was me. And then about a year later, my brother was born, and she had a nervous breakdown shortly after that from her mother probably dying when she was 11 years old, and difficulty with her, the way she was brought up, and her sister became a hardcore, very solid woman with ulcers and very decisive. And my mother became what appeared to be a very weak woman. She was Elizabeth Taylor Gorgeous, and because of my association with her in that way, the way I grew up with women is I thought that they were, if they were pretty, it meant that they were stupid, because I interpreted that lack of ability to put things together in her head and all the emotional problems she was having as a lack of intelligence. And she was always very nice with my dad and all, who's 10 years older than her. And I equated that with women, meaning that if you're really nice, that meant you're weak. And so I grew up with this very warped image of women. And there was a lot of other prejudice in the house. My father was from the South, so I grew up with that. And my father worked very hard, and my mother did the best she could. I know today my mother and father did the best they could, and I love them very much. They've been long past, but I was a very wild and crazy kid. Both my brothers and I were all screwed up. One's into some kind of pay type religion. I won't mention the name because I want to sound like I'm judging other religions. And another brother of mine, we're all Jewish, and he went back to Orthodoxy, but he just kind of nuts, and and has all those problems. And both my brothers one brother went to MIT and Cornell. He has a PhD in physics. Another brother is like a genius in tax accounting, and I'm an accountant myself. But my dad graduated high school, and he was and skipped three grades. And so my mom was a school teacher, so it was not like a lack of intelligence in the family. But I grew up in public schools, and I was like all D's and F's in the first and second grade, always getting into trouble, and stealing came naturally to me. I stole from my mother all the time, and if anybody ever suspected, I could always say, well, it was her mental sickness, that's what she thought, and I would blame that. And I blamed a lot of things on that. On her illness and all of my problems I had in my life, I blamed on her, because and it was interesting that this morning's topic in OA meeting I was at was blame. And last night I was at the San Fernando Valley, one of the marathon meetings was conference out there. Topic was We're Not Saints, and I was kind of putting those two together in my mind, and I blamed everybody and everything. So I, with stealing, of course, I was not a big time thief like my AA sponsor was, robbing banks and things. But if it wasn't nailed down, I would steal it, And I stole all the time. My parents used to frisk me, you know, and I would hide the money in my underwear and then go to the hobby shops. I remember this kid saw me doing that one time, and he started to blackmail me. He threatened he was going to tell my parents and all that. And you know, there was a time when he used to put a knife to my throat and threaten that he would kill me. And, you know, when you're 9, 10 years old, and somebody does that, you pretty much believe it. And I grew up really screwed up in a lot of ways. And we grew up in nice neighborhoods. I mean, and my dad moved about every 3 or 4 years when, you know, he'd play the commodities, and very intelligent and very compulsive in gambling. And I didn't see that, and I didn't like to even talk about that until years later in the program, long after I got sober. I was always in a lot of fights and a lot of trouble. And in third grade, I tried to straighten out my act a little bit. I always trying to impress people. I remember I used to kill bees with my bare hand on the cement. You know, if you slam your hand on them real fast. I remember I was trying to impress this girl one time about doing that, and I hit the bee in the grass, and then started to sting the hell out of me. I'm jumping up and down screaming, and she's laughing, and, you know, nothing worse than being laughed at, I'll tell you. But so I just grew up kind of wild and crazy, and of course lying goes along without stealing. You know, it was necessary. I could tell you 2 and 2 is 5, and, you know, make you believe it. You know, and that is not exactly a recipe for success, if you want to be honest. It's a recipe for short-term success, maybe, but long-term, no. So I always had trouble in school. My brother was a year younger than me. He was always doing really well. And I had a lot of fights, a lot of trouble, and I got into the alcohol and drugs. But I was probably compulsively overeating from 5 years old on. You know, I mean, I remember when I got abstinent, and I'm abstinent about 4 years and 2 months and 18 days now. But who's counting? But I remember talking to one of my guy I knew in OA. He was sober and absent like 20 years. And I was talking about how it's harder, it seems to be, to do the food thing than the sobriety thing. And he said, well, how long were you drinking and using? I said, well, from around age 9 to around 18, almost, 19 almost. And it's like 10 years, right? And he said, yeah. And I said, yeah. And he said, well, how long were you overeating? I said, well, and at this time it was like 56. I said, well, about 50, 51 years. And he said, yeah, it's going to take a little longer to get over that upset. So, and he was right. And I always went to the food. I was always a compulsive eater. I can remember my grandpa Jack, because my father worked a lot of hours, and my mom, she did the best she could, but my grandpa Jack, who was on to my BS a lot, and he would call me on my stuff, and he could see right through me, hands down. And so, but he took the time to care about me, and he used to take me out. He took me to circuses, and he would take me out to dinner a lot, and he was a very jovial guy, and I used to hate him on one hand, and I loved him on the other. And he used to give me these big, sloppy, wet kisses all over my face, and I say, well, Grandpa, don't give me those wet kisses. And he said, let it soak in. You know, he had this raspy voice because he had cancer at one time in his throat. They removed his vocal cords. He had a raspy voice. But he looked like he was 80, 85 with diabetes and everything. My life could have been good. It should have been great, but I was always in trouble. And I could never relate with people. I was always trying to impress people. And I got into, like, you know, the violence thing. Not that I was a really bad dude from, you know, East LA or anything like that, but I was always in trouble like that. I was known as the kid with the ice pick. I'd go on some of these kids' lawns and 7, 8, 9, 10 years old throwing this ice pick up in the air with the kids there, and just crazy. I remember eventually I kind of had a nervous breakdown and copped out about the stealing, and then my parents got involved and with the principal, and they caught the guy, and that was that. But I was stealing for many years into sobriety. I got into the, you know, I'm Jewish, and so, you know, they drink the Manischewitz wine at Passover and things like that. I got into drinking at 9 years old, and I drank a quarter, 3/4 of that bottle of wine. If alcohol was around, I did that. And if you were doing drugs, I did that. And there was always food. I mean, you know, pizza and all that stuff. I was always binging on that stuff when we were drinking and throwing it up. That never stopped me from drinking or using, and it didn't stop me from overeating. There's not enough food. You know, if the pizza was the size of all these people here, there's not enough pizza, you know, for me to fill that hole that I had. And I would try to desperately to fill that hole, the fear that was going on with my parents and all their problems, and and you know, fear of women. You know, I had like 3 years of fairly hardcore child molestation because my parents were leaving me with the babysitters, and you know, and I was very confused when I got sober because I thought I was gay because of all that child molestation, and I got into some of that stuff as far as that sexual activity. It was with a friend of mine, and I didn't know what to make of myself, and thank God that his mother had caught us and got me out of that. But when I came to, finally got sober, I didn't know, you know, if I was gay or not. And I'm not knocking gay people, and there's a big difference between being gay and being a child molester. But I had all that stuff in my head, and I'd even talked about it in therapy. I went to group therapy at, you know, when I was on probation because I got arrested for possession of marijuana. I didn't talk about it there, but I was also in group therapy with my school, and this wonderful black guy named Caldwell Williams. He's probably long gone now. He was my counselor, and he tried to help me a lot. And I tried getting into karate to help get out of that fear, and I was going crazy nonstop on that for 7 days a week. And I mean, now I probably couldn't fight my way out of a paper bag, but you know, back then I was doing okay. And I tried to go to that therapy and reading books to stop drinking, and because I could see there was a problem with the alcohol and drugs. The food I never saw a problem with. I just, you know, when I wanted to eat, I just ate all the time. And my weight would go up and down, but I never got to be hundreds of pounds overweight because I was physically active a lot. But I was never really dieting. I tried to restrict and cut back a little bit, but I never really was successful in that. And by the time I, between, say, 15 and 16 and a half, I got into alcohol and drugs very heavy. And grades started going down, lost all my friends. And from 16 and a half to like 19, I tried various ways to stay sober, to get off the alcohol and drugs. And I always went back to it. I wasn't doing it 7 days a week, but a lot. Smoking grass, I was doing that a lot. Drinking, you know, 3 or 4 times a week sometimes. And getting drunk most of the time. And laying in my vomit or urine. It just didn't matter. And I got into hallucinogenic drugs and all that stuff. You know, I would try to stay sober on and off. And I finally, a friend of mine I used to drink with was coming to AA, and his name is Bob S. I don't know if he's sober anymore. I haven't seen him in 20, 25 years. And he was pretty much a pure alcoholic. He pretty much only drank alcohol. And not like me, because I did like everything. I was a garbage can. He brought me to my first AA meeting, which was the Santa Monica Way of Life meeting meets in Santa Monica. And I didn't think I was alcoholic, but I identified with the main speaker, a guy who's still sober today named Marv R. And I heard about this thing called OA. And so I started going, you know, I didn't think I was alcoculic, but I thought, well, I'm an overeater. Maybe I should check that out. And I started going to these meetings, Olympic and Crescent Heights and all that stuff. So this is like 42 years ago. I really, I got a sponsor, but you guys were speaking Chinese to me. I could not understand anything you were saying to me at all. It's just none of it made sense. And I was in and out of OA insanely. And you got to realize, coming off all the alcohol and drugs and being on PCP and all that stuff, I mean, I was just a total space cadet. I dropped out of college in my second semester. I lost every friend I had. My best drinking and drug using buddy used to cough up blood drinking. Even he didn't want to be with me anymore. And I'd say, Rob, why don't you want to be with me? He said, because you can read people's minds. I said, well, I can read their minds. I just total space case. I hallucinating a lot. I used to feel these ants crawling on me for the first 3 months of sobriety. I just a total space cadet. But, you know, I was in and out of AA for the first 4 months, and I started to stay sober finally. And AA was good. And my first AA sponsor got me going back to work, and eventually got me to move out of my parents' house after a year. I got fired from jobs left and right, and I had no idea how to function, really, but my first AA sponsor was hardcore. And as I often say to many people in AA meetings, that I would not tell someone to do what I did, but you know, he would make me go to my job after my Friday night men's stag. I'd have to go to work on graveyard, a jack in a box for $1.65 an hour, and he'd make me go to the yard with no sleep. And I said, Tom, I got to have some sleep. He says, you don't need it; you'll get it later. And then he said I couldn't take a nap before the Saturday meeting because he knew I'd oversleep and be late. And then he said parties back then. They still have the parties, but then back then they read like 15 cards and for each party. And so, and then we go out to dinner and coffee afterwards. So it'd be like 44, 45 hours not sleep. And fortunately, I got fired from my job after about 6 weeks. I quit like 2 seconds before they were going to fire me. And I got a job with another guy in AA, and he fired me after 3 days. But it was a tough job. I had to hose the cars down and turn on the engines and sweep the floors. It was pretty high tech. So anyway, so after about 5 years of writing two major fourth and fifth steps, changing sponsors, because my first sponsor moved away after 3.5 years, and being a super activist in the Pacific group and practicing these principles outside of the meetings and none of my affairs. Totally self-will, run right out of control outside of the meetings. And I'd been in the Santa Monica track club, had lost my weight, went into basic combat training with the military, and was back from them. And so I'd been in a lot of good physical stuff, but the food came back on me yet again and again and again. And I started coming to OA, and like I said, I was like 5 years sober, and after 3 or 4 months, I lost like 45 pounds in like 3.5, 4 months, and people in OA were asking me to speak all over the place. So this is like, 37 years ago, roughly. And I was like this OA superstar speaking all over, and I knew everything. And I remember this one guy who was sober and in OA told me, he said, "You're getting real cocky." And I said, yeah, don't bother me. Because when you know all the answers, you know all the answers. And I knew my way right back out those doors. I met my late wife at that time, we hooked up, we started dating, after about 3 weeks, we started going hot and heavy nonstop, seeing each other all the time. There was nothing like you're calling me too much and you're stalking me. I mean, we didn't have any of that. We just couldn't get enough of each other. And we were with each other for like 2 years before we got married. During that first year, we both, because she had been in OA in New York and lost like 150 pounds, and she'd been absent for like 2 years. And both of us just kind of, walked away from OA. And Don Bagley had been my OA sponsor. I'm breaking his name because he's died. He was about 44 years sober and about 35 years absent, I think. And he did a lot for me. But I remember I was very active in AA and had many good things happen to me, and my life got good in many ways. But all the crap was always still there, and if I wanted to drink or use, push came to shove, I could always eat, and I did. And I gained my weight and lost weight, and gained it and lost it. My wife passed away from cancer after a 5-year battle and left me with 4 kids about 10 years ago. I guess I started going back to the AA Men's Stag on Friday night, and a guy named Michael B., who I'd seen, went out and drank and used again, and I saw him about 20 years ago come back, and I was with him a little bit during that time, he was eating out for dinner, and I said, "Gee," after a couple of weeks, I said, "Gee, Michael, you're really eating healthy, aren't you?" And he started talking to me about OA and everything else. And one of the reasons I didn't want to come back to OA, besides my ego and everything else, I didn't want to call in my food to anybody. I just didn't want to give you guys that power and control. Screw you, I'm not going to give you that power. Sorry about the slip there on the language. But I just was adamant about that. And walking in that parking lot with Michael after going out to dinner, I was willing to crawl through 50 yards of broken glass to call my food into him, and to do whatever he said. And I said, "Can I just start calling my food into you?" And I started calling him every day. And after a week, I asked him, "Well, would you be my OA sponsor?" And he said, "I thought I already was." I said, "No." I said, no, because my AA sponsor, when I came back from basic combat training and advanced training with the military, he suggested I get a new sponsor. And after 3 months of Don in sponsoring me, I thanked him from the podium for being my sponsor. And after I got off the podium after a meeting, he said, "You never asked me to be your sponsor." I said, "Don, would you be my sponsor?" And I remembered that to humble myself. And I did that with Michael because I knew I was going to have to give my all to this thing no matter what. And Michael said, "Okay, well, you got to go to at least one OA meeting a week," because he knew I was an AA. And I said, "Fine." But I knew inside. And first, I hemmed and hawed for the first week. He said, "I don't know how to tell you. I can only tell you what I did. I go to OA meetings. I go through the steps, if you want what we have, you got to do what we do." And I started to do what he told me to do. And I got going to 2 OA meetings. I go pretty much every Saturday morning and Monday evening. I've got commitments at those meetings because he told me I had to do the same thing in AA. I had to respect the OA program the same way I respect the AA program. And he taught me to do that, and I have more sobriety in him, and every once in a while I think I'm smarter and more knowledgeable in him. He reminds me that the units are not transferable. And I gotta remember that. Because I got a big fat ego, and it's real easy for me to think that I know the answers, and I can do it my way. And I gotta remember, my way got me 90 pounds overweight. I don't know how overweight it was. When I came back to you guys, I was going up and down on my way back up. I guess I was like 223 or something. And when I came back for the umpteenth time to try to deal with my weight problem, it came back to OA finally. But I'd been in the 243s, 240, I don't know how much, but a good 90 pounds overweight. And, I'm on my last 10 pounds. It's been a slow battle with that day by day. But, I've got to do what he says, and it's a battle when I don't do what he says. And I learned from him that, and from this program, at least the way that he and I work, is that my abstinence is not perfect. It's not all black or white. Perfect abstinence, and I think it's important for me to remember that, because that all or nothing attitude is what kept me going back. It's so easy for me to say, well, the hell with it, and just binge out of my mind, and because I haven't had that all or I've tried to give up that all or nothing attitude, and I try to do that in at work too, because I've had a lot of problems on the job, but thank God they put up with my BS for a long time, and because I do a decent job in some other areas, and I try to take this out there about. Before I got abstinent, but about 4 months before my wife died, the women from the temple, many of her friends were coming by, and they'd rub her legs. And, there's a saying that God will do for us what we kind of do for ourselves. And something melted that icy steel with women inside me. And I was like 30 years sober. It's not, most people get past this a long time. But, when I was eating in the program, there were many times when I just needed to grow, and I didn't have to grow because I could eat. And the last 4 years of my sobriety, and I'm 41 years sober now, the last 4 years of that has been a growth. I'm not Mr. Growth, but I'm saying, I've made more progress because I've had to work through this stuff instead of eat through it. And, my boss is female. We get along great, and she's a wonderful boss. I got a couple other female bosses. But the point is like this whole world opened up to me. With women that I'm able to listen to now, that there was a few that I would always listen to, some hardcore tough ones, and like Millie G, she's not hardcore but tough, but she's hardcore honest and loving, and so there's a few women I did listen to, but many I shut my mind off, and just like with black people and everything else, and or if you weren't educated and all these little things, I used to have all these barriers, and little by little these barriers have come down, and the more they come down, the more I can learn from you, and maybe help someone newer sicker than me, and hopefully it's not because I'm thinking about what I'm going to get out of it. My AA sponsor taught me something really important one time when I said, gee, I got to get to a meeting because I'm really, feeling it. I got to get there. He said, don't go to the meeting for what you can take. Go to for what you can give. So, sometimes I think, well, this means a crappy meeting. And I had to learn, go to the meeting. If I talk to someone new or sick, or whether it's an OA meeting or an AA meeting, in Santa Clarita where I live, the OA meetings are small. But, it's, there's a lot of recovery there in those meetings, and I learned from those people, and most of them are women too, and a lot of them are beautiful on the inside, and I had to learn that was a discovery I made, and they've helped me a lot, and the people and all these programs help me a lot. I often say I'm a sick bastard. I got to go to AA and OA and Al-Anon and all this other stuff, and I don't like to talk about that much from the podium because it's confusing to the newcomer, and they start thinking, well, you got to go to these programs. For me, it was necessary to hear the message, and I started going to Al-Anon to help my middle daughter. She's not drinking or using, but I had some very serious problems with her, and it's been helpful. So, little by little, my life is getting better, and it's because of you people. And if you're new and you haven't heard anything I said, that's okay. Just keep coming back, or better yet, don't go away. Thank you for my life. The question is the gentleman wanted me to describe what my daily spiritual practice is. And the first thing I'll say about spirituality is I learned, like, gratitude. Gratitude is an action. Spirituality is an action. But I get out of bed on my knees as soon as possible. If I can make it before the bathroom, I do that. I thank my higher power, God, as I understand him, for another day of sobriety, another day without a few other things, and another day of abstinence. And my abstinence is, three meals a day, and I call some snacks in with that, and, healthy stuff, yogurt, fruit, whatever. But, I get out of bed in the morning, and I thank God for those things. I ask him to manage my life and restore me to sanity, and I do third step prayer a couple of ways. You know, God, please help me accept the seemingly bad along with seemingly good as necessary for my growth. I learned that from a guy named Keith Carpenter, who was an AA, a sober many years. And God, please help me accept whatever comes my way as your will for me this day. So, and I try to do that third step prayer. It's from the book, I think it's page 63. And I try to read it because I'm so used to saying it rotely that I don't always hear what I'm saying. And I go on to do steps 6 and 7, and then if I did my 10th step the night before, which I usually try, I don't always get it done. It's the night before, sometimes I do it in the morning, like I did it with Michael today, later today. You know, I do the AEIOU format, and I'll call him 7 days a week, and I call in the food, you know, I do the AEIOU thing with him in the morning, and we'll read like Voices of Recovery and the Courage to Change, or some literature like that, to read something to me. And then when I'm done, you know, we do some prayers together, usually in the morning, or if not, I do some additional prayers and try to do the 11th step, you know, ask my higher God, please direct my thinking this day, may it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Please grant me an intuitive thought or decision where I face the decision. And then it says, you know, to pause, you know, at that point there, you know, and it's, you know, after we've meditated a little bit. And I try to do like 30 seconds or something, just closing my eyes. And I'm not perfect at it or anything like that. And then I say, God, may I be shown all throughout this day what my next step is to be. May I be given whatever I need to take care of the problems that arise. And may I be free from self-will in all that I do. And I try to do the next part, you know, ask them, I remember to pause and agitated or doubtful to ask you for the right thought or action, and to constantly remind myself that I am no longer running the show, humbly saying many times each day, thy will be done. And then I get on the road and curse out people and go crazy at work and get all pissed off at the computer because I you would never know I had any program at all, because near the end of the day I'm so drained and burned out in front of that freaking computer because the thing goes so slow, and I get so pissed off that they make us use this software. In the meantime, I got to be grateful to God on my knees, I got a job. So that just tells you I just need meetings. And so my spirituality is that, you know, I make outreach calls. You know, I try to remember, I don't do one every day, but I try to make them and call my, whether it be my OA brothers or somebody else. And a lot of these people that are in OA are in AA too, so it's kind of an extra good thing for me. You know, I make those calls and I receive the calls. And if I give out my phone number to someone newer or sicker, you know, because to me, that's all the spiritual I'm putting together. You know, to me, when I'm sweeping up a floor or at this podium, they're all spiritual things. You know, last week they asked me for participate, or a week, almost 2 weeks ago, they asked me to participate in an event, and I got to do something there, and I can help out as a cashier and sat with this lady Julie that my OA sponsor used to sponsor, and you know, it's just spirituality was helping her, you know, with the accepting people's money and taking care of that stuff because I was participating in an event, and it made me feel good. So it's not just getting on my knees and talking to God, because I recognize that there's a God, He's out there, and the most important thing to recognize is it's not me. So I don't know if that answered your question, but hopefully it did.